Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Hey guys, welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig and it is 9 o'clock, which means it's time for another Talk Magic. And I'm here with one of my favorite creators of magic and performers, Mike Powers. Hey Mike, how you doing? You okay?
I am doing great, my friend. It's a nice day here. Of course, it's a little cold. What's the temperature in London there? Are you in London?
I'm not in London. I'm in Staffordshire, in near Birmingham.
Okay.
And it's freezing. It's snowing outside at the moment. So,
sorry I asked.
Yeah, really cold, really cold. We've had about 2 weeks of snow, which is, my kids love it, but I prefer to be in the warmth, to be honest. I'm not a snow guy, to be honest.
We've had a little bit, but crossed my fingers crossed that I won't have to get the snow blower out this year. But yeah, it is winter. What are we going to do?
Exactly. But you know what, Mike? I know you're a busy guy. And I really appreciate you you coming on the channel, just because you have created so much magic. You are responsible, and this is something I'm going to get into later on, but you're responsible for so many iconic creations in magic that, you know, people talk about, and they have, you know, what I'm trying to say is sometimes a trick will come out and 10 years later it will be forgotten. But a lot of the stuff that you've brought out has remained in people's repertoires for 20, 30 years. And that's a testament to yourself as a creator. So I'm really glad that you found time to come on the channel. So thank you so much.
Very happy to be here, Craig. It's an honor to be on your show.
So let's for the people that haven't heard of Mike Powers, let's start at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. When did you get into magic? Was it the typical story of a child that was given a magic set? Or when did you kind of get bitten by the bug?
Yeah, you know, try to keep it short. I think some of these stories can get very long, but my dad took us to a trade show one time, which I can still remember way back, and I won't mention my age, 74, January 20th, but anyway, it was a long time ago. I was probably 10, and there was a guy selling Svengali decks and nickels to dimes. And when I saw this close up, those nickels disappear and become dimes, I just had a, you know, out of body experience. I've never seen magic done that way. You know, I'd seen magic on TV. We grew up with Mark Wilson's Magic Land of Alakazam in California, where I grew up. Anyway, so the bug bit me, and I always loved to watch magic. And one time around late 70s, a friend of mine, whom I graduated from Notre Dame with, was visiting, and we drove back to New York, where he had moved after grad school. And he was a juggler, and we went to Tannen's, which I had never heard of, and he wanted to get some juggling stuff, and I was wandering around, and they demonstrated a invisible deck. I'll take that. Some flash paper, because New Year's Eve was coming up. I thought that would be fun, which it was, and everybody lost their eyebrows, because I took all 12 8.5 by 11 sheets into a giant ball of, I didn't realize, and threw a match in there. So there was that. Anyway, I got a thing called Roné's Sympathetic Aces, which is still available, I think. It was an Emerson & West product, I believe. And it was demonstrated by someone at Tannen's. At the end of this twisting thing where the cards are turning face up and face down, all the backs are blue, all throughout the thing, tons of blue, everything is blue. All of a sudden, the backs are all different colors. And I just wanted to touch the cards, and he goes, oh, sure. What? They're not tricky cards? No, you can pick up the cards. I'll take that. But of course, that involved sleight of hand, Elmsley count and Jordan count. So when I got back, I pulled it out of the drawer. I'm going to learn this trick. The instructions were written on the back of one on the back of each side of a playing card. Like in, that was the Jordan count. That was the Elmsley count. That was it. No illustrations. So I'm going, what the hell are they talking about? You know, anyway, long story. Try to shorten the story a little bit. I finally got through it and figured out, oh my God, if I could do this smoothly, they would see what I saw and I could give them the experience that I had. And I did it for my wife, and she was like, holy moly. okay, I want to be a magician. So this was when I was like almost 30, when I really finally got the bug. I found someone who was a very lucky find, a teacher that really knew the cool stuff, like Frank Garcia books and Harry Lorraine, and he even had Martin Nash and Marlowe and all this stuff that got me really into it. So you know how when the bug bites you, it like gets the teeth in deep? Well, that was me. So, I mean, I was just practicing constantly. But that was sort of the path that got me going. And one day after having Marlowe magazine, I was working on the combination pass in the private, you know, I had no, couldn't see it, didn't know if I was doing it right. But I heard Marlowe would come into Magic Inc. on Saturday, and that he didn't mind talking to people. So I went up there, and Ed Marlowe walks in, and I went, holy moly. You know, finally, Mr. Marlowe, you know, I was working on this thing in this book. He goes, hey, come on with me. We're going down to the Pickle Barrel restaurant. What? Get in the car with Ed, just me and Ed. And he's talking, he's handing me letters from Rackerbaumer. Read this, Rackerbaumer. You know, I mean, I'm just like, holy moly. You know, so anyway, we get to the Pickle Barrel. Nobody's there. We would normally be Aaronson Solomon, Drawn, Wakeman, Don England, maybe Ellen Eckerman, not at that point in time. You know, the crew that was the Marlowe people. And I was just with Ed, drinking his wine, had a cigar. And I mean, I was just, finally I pick up my cards and go, you know, here's what I'm trying to do with this combination pass. And he's going, well, you know, do this. And we don't want to go too far deep into here. I think I've taken up enough time. But anyway, that was the inspiration of like, wow, I need to go back. And if I ever come up here again, he needs to see that I've really, really practiced and learned something. So that became my, you know, besides practicing a lot, they had this goal of like, when you go to see Ed the next time, because you could come to the table and they would just go, hey, sure, sit down, Mike. It was fantastic. So about once a month, once every 6 weeks, I'd go up there and hang out with that crew. So how about that? Bill Malone, Simon, Dave, you know, all these guys. And just what an inspiration. So that's kind of the journey that got me into magic hardcore.
That's incredible. And obviously, fast forward many, many years, now people know you as a performer and a creator. When did you take that leap from meeting Ed Marlowe and studying magic and get bitten by the bug to being a performer and a creator? How did that journey go? Was that something that happened over? Because that's something that a lot of people watch this channel. They are new to magic and they want to know how to go from, you know, a passionate hobby to making a living out of magic. Is that, how did that journey look for you?
Yeah, no, I've got, there's a, this dovetails perfectly into that question, I think. I have to say that I'm more of a creator and thinker and a writer and tweaker of magic than the performer. I admire people who love to be on stage. You know, I work in a restaurant, or I have worked in a restaurant a couple times a week, that kind of thing. I've never been full time, but I really enjoy close up magic. I enjoy sitting down at the table, going to somebody's table, being at a cocktail party. And I had a stand-up show, but nothing that I would ever do for magicians. It was just standard stuff that everybody does for folks that would hire me to do a corporate show, that kind of thing. So they don't care if you created it or not. They just wanted to see good magic. But being around these creative guys like Simon and Dave and Ed, I mean, talk about prolific, the gears start turning and you start playing with a trick and realizing, this trick has problems. And then you realize, wait a minute, you know, I've got a whole new idea that isn't even this trick anymore. You know, it kind of got me started, and you have these inspirational sources kind of thing. So around 1983, I've got a book right over here, and I'll, if I can use my crazy gear here, I'll switch over to another view. This is something that I wrote in 1983. And I had a guy that locally do this artwork. It's a paperback book. And I managed to get tricks. If you look at the, I don't know if anybody can read this.
Yes, see that, yeah.
There's a tricks from Marlowe, Ed Marlowe, three tricks. Gary Kurtz, let's see who else is in here. Jay Sankey, Simon Aronson, Dave Solomon. So there's some things that these guys contributed, some ideas to the book. Now, there was 500 printed, and it did sell out, and it got a good review. And I think it was Richard's Almanac back at the time. And, you know, when I look back on it, I go, wow, what were you thinking when you came up with that trick? So there's some really cool ideas in here that when I revisit them, I go, okay, well, now that you've been doing this stuff for like 40 years, you have a chance to really understand some things that you didn't understand at that point. So this has been in magic, say, for 4 years, and I'm thinking I'm going to write a book. You know, there is some good stuff in here. I mean, I'm proud of some of the ideas in here, but it's not my best work either. So I think that if you're new to magic, let's come back to where you can see me. Sorry. If you're new to magic and, you know, trust your instincts, practice a lot, read a lot, watch videos a lot. I mean, then you get a chance to see someone actually performing magic and get ideas. Try not to imitate, try to be yourself. I think these are all good ideas. But don't feel like you have to, you know, like reading music. I have to just play these notes because that's the music. Think about what you're doing. Think about what could make it better. Think about things like, you know, instead of trying to clean up the trick, oh, there's a reversed card in the deck. Think, well, wait a minute, that could be exactly what I need to do that trick. So a liability can be an asset in that regard. So you start to think about these things, and your creativity goes to work. So I think everybody has some creativity. Let it out. I think that's what everybody needs to do, right?
Exactly. And talking about creativity, that's another thing that magicians really want to learn more of. They want to create their own magic. A lot of magicians, they would love to write a book on magic. They'd love to create their own magic. Where do you find inspiration? Let's take one of your most iconic tricks, which I'm thinking would be diminishing returns. I think that's something that put you on the map. I mean, I still do that. And I did a Zoom show today and I did that in my Zoom show. It is the perfect. I just ordered another one off you, as you know, because I started doing it in my Zoom show and I'm like, I don't want to accidentally lose this or something. This is now a feature of my act. I'm going to have to contact Mike and get another one because this is, let's take that as an example. How did you go from the starting point to creating a trick that magicians perform all over the world?
Yeah, that's a good question. That really has been the trick that lasted past, you know, the 1 year mark or the 6 month mark or the 1 month mark that we have these days, right? Mm-hmm. What's the new thing? This was passé after a month. In the old days, we didn't have this glut, if you will. And I think there's lots of good magic coming out every day. So, I mean, I'm not trying to put down people for putting stuff out quickly. There's a lot of crap out there as well, as we all know, but lots of good stuff coming out, lots of creative authors. You know, to me is the golden age of magic, you know, in terms of creativity, lots of people thinking. I would talk to Paul Harris years ago, maybe 1980 or something. And I remember vividly him saying, there's like six people. I mean, he said something like, there's six people doing all the thinking in magic. Now, he didn't mean literally six that he was going to name. He just meant very few people are creating stuff. But that's no longer the case. And there's an amazing number of people that have been doing magic for 2 years and you go, my God, this guy's ideas are fabulous. You know, I mean, I've got books back here by authors that are younger than my kids, you know, of course, since I'm so old, my kids are old too. Anyway, diminishing returns, it starts with micro macro. So if you go back to Brother Hammond, you're going to have a very practical trick, which is a normal deck that appears to be a mini deck. Now, with a little work, which I don't think he did, if you take one of the cards from Diminishing Returns and inject it into the Hammond routine, you can have a face-up appearance of a mini card's face in a face-down spread. And now there's only two gaffed cards in play, one to make it look like a spread, the top card, and the one that you've used. You'd have to force the card. So I think Diminishing Returns, you know, you start thinking, well, what if they named a card? And then you'd think, well, what if the named card was, you know, the only miniature card. And then the whole, then you start, then as soon as you conceive of that gaffed card that the deck is based on, it just falls into place. And then it's just handling from there. So it's just these little things that hit you. You know, we don't know, the muses are active, and all of a sudden you just go, oh, wow. So that one has been, because it's such a good dealer item, I think is where its longevity comes from. It's like Color Monty or the Invisible Deck. If somebody comes into your shop, you just go, they go, okay, I'll take that Invisible Deck. What? I'll take that Color Monty. I'll take, you know, and then it's like, well, what about this one? How hard is that? Just do this. Okay, I'll take that one. Because it is an easy trick to do. So it's got the right characteristics. I don't ever really try to do that. I've never really been one to go, I guess at the end of the day, if you think, well, wait a minute, this is too difficult. It's not saleable. So, you know, maybe I can do it, or people that have certain skills can do it. But then you can think, well, this could be a marketable item. And then you have to address those issues and say, can I get it down to where there's at least one version of it that's accessible to the average magician? And when you can, then you can just say, and if you know this move and this move, you could do this. I tend to do that a lot with the things that I write up. Try to say, you know, this is sort of the basic version that's accessible if you know basic card magic, but there's better ways to do things. You can up your game a little bit and do this. Oh, you could be happy with that. But once you see what it looks like with these additions, sometimes you go, okay, back to the practice boards. I need to do that. But most of things have an evolution. I think Ed and a lot of people say it. I remember Ed just saying it. Don't stop thinking too soon. That's some really good advice for anybody who's listening and creating something. And I tend to think, I got it. You know, I mean, I'm really have to fight the feeling of like, nope, that's it. And later on, maybe if we have time, I'll show you something that I just recently went back to the drawing boards on, exactly in that regard, going, you know, that's a good trick, but there's some things I don't like. And all of a sudden you just sit down, you spend about 2 days and you get kind of obsessed with the thing. And over time, I mean, I wake up at 3 a.m. and go, you know, now, wait a minute, how can I make sure I can get back so I can do this walk around and reset that deck? You know, that's going to be important if I'm really going to do this in the real world. I don't want to have to go to the restroom and reset something and come back out to continue my walk around gig here. But diminishing returns. I love topological things. I knew Don England really well, and he had a trick called Plastic Lady that actually I bought the rights to and is in my, will be coming out again in this year. I have got the cards made. I just have to get off my butt and get out there and create, you know, go to Murphy's or Penguin or somebody and say, hey, you guys want to buy into this and get it going. It's a wonderful trick with a shrinking card. And I love topological stuff like that. In fact, there's a trick in this book that if you don't, I think when you got the instructions for diminishing returns, did you find the ambiguous card in as an addition?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
That's in here. That's one of the really good ones that's in this book, which is not available in any form really anymore, but it's a real cool addition to diminishing returns where, you know, you have a normal deck and the card they select kind of jumps out of the deck and becomes a miniature card. But then as you extract it from the deck, it becomes big again. And then you get another visual change back to small. So I've always had an affinity for topological stuff, especially shrinking, growing, and it just, you know, diminishing returns was sort of like, wow, and very lucky to have that right chemistry of ease of execution, super strong. So you get that ratio of how hard is it to how powerful it is, and it's astronomical in that trick. It's so visual and pretty darned easy. That's what you want. I mean, that's a winner.
Absolutely. And how important, you're talking about revisiting plots and working material in. You also said about how there's a lot of tricks that are coming out these days that aren't that great. And that is unfortunately true. There's a lot of, especially downloads that comes out that's not wonderful at all. For people that are creating downloads, What advice would you give them in order to, you know, make the trick as good as it possibly can be, as opposed to bringing out something that gets negative reviews?
Yeah, well, I think partly it's going to be to make your production value look good. You know, I've been working really hard on that. I'll give you a real quick tour. Check this out, man. This is one view using OBS. So I'm over here in the view that, you know, you can see the pad, but then I've got the upper right corner for the close-up, or I could even do the over-the-shoulder shot and have three cameras at the same time. This is where I'm at in the big picture. And the shot that you've been looking at is just this much cut out of this shot by OBS. So this is the exact, I'm pointing right at the OBS camera right there that's creating this shot. And when I go back to the closer up, that's just OBS software saying, Mike told you to cut this out and make that the full screen so that you come in close. But this is this is half my library. The other three shelves are above that. But then I can do the total view of this, total view of that, or the close-up view that we've been looking at. And then I've even got one more crazy view that for a Zoom show that we're going to be doing, where I realized I need to stand up. So then as long as we're taking this tour, I'll do the work. So first I have to do this, then I can do that and stand up. And now I'm in the Zoom scene with an overlay. It's a little kind of funky looking, but it leaves out a lot of crap that would be in this shot normally, right? There's a lot of junk over here that it just clutters up the shot. Why not cut it down to the essentials thing? So if I'm going to do a rope trick with a, you know, cut and restored rope, well, it's 6 feet of rope. I can't be sitting down here and do it. So now I'm using my switcher to switch back, and then I'll go back to this view. I'm getting pretty good at not screwing up my, you know, which view do we need to be in. But anyway, I would say if you're doing downloads, get some good stuff and at least edit stuff. Get multiple camera shots, and I do see a lot of good stuff. But the crap usually, you know, they're just shot in their basement with somebody walking around, and, you know, I won't point any fingers at people, but I've seen people putting out DVDs that were shot in their bedroom with an open door into the living room with some kids' clothes on the floor. This is literally true. And your head chopped off below the eyes because you didn't know what was going out. And then when you looked at it, you just said, good enough, and made a DVD from Discmasters and charged $30. I'm going, are you kidding me? So don't do that.
That's great advice.
High quality project. Take pride in what you're doing. I mean, my God, how easy is it to reshoot stuff until it's perfect? You know, I'm a 20 taker usually. You know, by the 20th take, it'll be perfect. But along the way, I make every possible mistake when I'm, you know, cooking something up. So it seems so that it's like that sometimes anyway.
Now, changing the subject a little bit, one thing that I've always loved about your magic is that there are so many magical moments happening in each routine. It's not just a kind of wham bam, thank you, ma'am. I remember you writing in Power Plays in the introduction that you, although you appreciate storytelling magic and you cited Eugene Berger at the time, you know, you prefer your magic to be, you know, kind of very hard hitting and lots of magic happening. And I really appreciate that. Is that something that you don't see a lot of people doing magic like that, but have you got any advice on how to actually be able to construct a routine and make it so that it is so magical? And again, so many examples I can cite, but Boston Massacre is a perfect example, you know. It's so wonderful. How do you go about creating a routine where there is so much magic, you know, as opposed to like a 10-minute story and a single payoff?
Well, it's a personal preference. I like magic that, first of all, I like magic to be really strong. I mean, that's the primary thing. I don't want to be cute. I'm not a comedian. I appreciate people who are humorous. I like to feel like I'm kind of in the group. I'm a little bit funny, but I'm not like dropping lines, especially lines that sound like lines. You know, when a good line sounds like it came from you spontaneously. that's hard to do sometime when you go the clean hand. You go, oh, well, first of all, it's a bad line, but it just smacks of like you've got this bag of lines over here and you just reached in and read one to the group, and it just doesn't feel real. I want to go in and feel like, hey, you know, I'm kind of your new friend here. We're all in this together. I'm the playmaker for this moment because I got the cards and stuff, and I'm kind of over here to entertain you guys. But we're all together, you know. You talk to me. Let's have eye contact. Let's become friends here. So that's the first thing I want to achieve. Then I want to hit them hard. I want them to just go, oh my God, what? I can't believe what I'm seeing here. You know, so that's the kind of magic that I'm looking for, rather than, isn't this a nice story to tell about the good forces and the evil forces and how these kings represent this? You know, I generally shy away from this represents anything. It's just cards, man. But when I snap this card, it just changed into your card right in front of your face. Or, you know, you were sure that your hand was on her card, but now it's your card and she has your card. And when that happens, those are like Sacco moments. I mean, just like, bam. And that's what I'm looking for. Now, there's plenty of magic that is kind of quick that can do that. But I think that if you do a series of those, it's like these jabs. It's just like, yep, there's one, there's one, there's one. And they're not really hard hitting. Usually hard hitting magic takes a little bit of buildup. It takes being convinced and having conviction. Yes, I really see that this is this. You know, magic, to me, magic should be performed at a slower pace. It's not a, come on, I'm coming out here, take this card, look at this. Oh, look at that. Okay, can you think of a card? You know, I mean, some people can do that and I think they're entertaining, but I think the magic in terms of its impact really suffers a lot of times in that kind of environment. So my personal style would be to perform, make sure everything is really clear. Yep. And looking for real serious conviction, taking extra time. Not, you know, you have to be careful about time and over, you know, like wasting time talking about something that is irrelevant to what's happening. But ultimately, I'm trying to set the stage for a moment of magic that's going to be really memorable. And almost everything that I'm doing in a, say, a 10-minute set, I want to be like that. So I'm not looking for that quick, here, take your card. Look, there's two jacks. Your card just appeared between the jacks. Okay, take a card. Your card's reversed in the deck. Okay, do this. I mean, you know, it's okay. And any one of those could be strong. And I think, you know, every one of those effects is a strong effect. But when you kind of sequence them in a way and slow it down and let people have an experience of magic, they end up getting the better experience of magic, I think, because it just has to hit hard. It just has to be impossible. You know, Simon Aronson, there's a couple quotes, Darwin and Simon, basically about it just has to end. It just has to be impossible to conceive that it could happen. As soon as they go, oh, he must have thrown it up his sleeve. Well, that means you should have rolled your sleeves up. You know, you didn't even sleeve it. And they think you did. Well, they got their explanation. You know, so these are little things that we learn along the way, I think, which is head off all explanations. It's got to just seem impossible.
That's really good advice. That's really good advice. I want to ask you one other question about that or about your magic, which is you tend to find a lot of magicians these days, they have one thing that they specialize in. You know, David Roth with coins and Darwin Ortiz with cards. You are quite different, or not? I mean, there are other people that do the same, but you have released and performed and created some amazing coin material, but also some amazing card material. What made you decide to do that? Because that's not something that a lot of people do in magic. They kind of maybe dip their toe in one area, but they have a speciality. But reading all of your books, it's kind of a 50-50 split right down the middle.
Well, probably more like 75-25 cards. If you do the math, I you know, in advertising, I think it helps the sales when you can say not all cards. You know, it's sort of like there's plenty of card tricks. I'm going to, full disclosure would be, I love Cards. I could watch Cards exclusively and be happy, I guess. But I you know, I think that's where my most of my work goes, is with Cards. But then you see something with coins, and I'm not a super coin guy, but I know enough coin moves to be able to construct some good stuff, and to appear to not give away the method while I'm performing. You know, so certainly we have to rise above that, to try to be very natural and get that conviction. But yeah, you know, I when I see something like Boston Massacre you mentioned earlier, if you knew Chad Long's work with the Boston Box,
yeah,
that's the starting point. And it's a good object lesson in creating something. And this also happened with a trick that's in the new book called New Jazz, which is a Jazz Aces variation. So since I'm not going to do it on the show, I wouldn't give away the method before showing the trick. But in both cases, I realized, you know what? If there was an extra card instead of just the 8 cards in the normal Jazz Aces, man, can that make that trick so much more convincing? And I just played around with it. And the new jazz in the new book, Tesseract, is one of my go-to tricks in there. Now, it's a good example of something where sometimes magicians would go, it's too slow for my cocktail hour show. Not enough happens quickly because it's an assembly. But I present it as, you know, this is what magicians do for each other. Would you like to see that? And it's a really good hook to where they go. It's not boring for them to see the setup about the leader ace or some of this terminology that we use. They don't know what that means, but you're telling them, this is what we say to each other, you know, so I'm bringing you into the inside track. So there are tricks that aren't like, that maybe they don't happen that fast, but what I'm thinking of here is how that came about by thinking, what if I had one extra card in there? And it just, to me, it really changed the trick and made it much, much stronger. And that's what happened with the Boston Box trick and Chad's original version. I thought, man, that is such a cool ending. But by adding one extra coin to the routine, it became so much more convincing. And there was no places where you had to do something that really was like, wait a minute, I think the magician did something there. That's one of my things that I try to keep in the front of my mind, especially if I video myself. And that's another good advice. Forget the mirrors, get your video camera out. You're gonna see what it really looks like. Don't watch yourself while you're performing. Do like a real performance. If you have to look at your hands, just look at your hands. Then watch the video and don't think that lay people are stupid. Think, you know, right there, I was fishing for that double. They know I'm doing something that's weakening the trick. So I've had some good epiphanies even recently this last year with COVID and being homebound a lot. I've made a lot more videos and watched myself going, man, I know you get away with that, but I know they must notice that you're doing something. Can't you do better? And I've gone back and tried to revamp or get tighter handling on some things. And I think I've become better as a result.
I think that's really important as well, because I think magicians have a tendency to learn a trick, go, right, I've learned it. That's in my performing bag. Let's learn another one without actually kind of mastering the trick and making sure it's the best it can be.
Yeah, well, that's the old Marlowe or whomever, don't stop thinking too soon. It's so easy to do. And the only time you really recognize that you did was when the weakness that needed to be fixed is noticed by people or somebody else fixes it. And then you go, that guy's got the right version. Why didn't I think of that? I just stopped thinking too soon. You know, it's always nice when somebody does a variation of your trick and then they say, you know, this is inspired by this, or I didn't like how this part was done and I changed it to this. You know, sometimes you go, it's a step backwards. What? Yeah. You know, and you kind of think, well, they, you know, thanks for the pointing out my trick, but I think the original was a better way to go than your new version of it. And then sometimes you go, nope, that's right. That's a better version. I should have thought of that. And Marlowe, although he's often accused of being a credit hound, which that might apply, he wasn't stealing things from people and claiming stuff that he didn't have. And one moment that I can still remember that I was personally there for was when he said, somebody pointed out something that somebody else had done with one of his tricks. I know what it was. Somebody had published a trick that he had thought of, the exact trick, but not published. And he lived and died by the published word tells you who is going to get credit for this trick. So somebody said, "Hey, Ed, check that out." He goes, he recognized that it was something that he had done, but not published. And he just went, "Shame on me." He basically just said, "That guy's got the credit. I should have published it. I'll just move on." But he didn't try to, you know, rag about, "Oh, I already had thought of that." And, you know, he just said, "No, I should have published it. And that guy gets credit." You know, fair enough.
Yeah, that's very true. Now, Mike, you mentioned something there, which I want to pick up on, which is adding an extra card to Jazz Aces in your new book. One thing that I've seen that you do an awful lot is you are not afraid to use gaffes. I mean, we talked about diminishing returns. There's so many gaff routines that you do. Some of them are gaff to the hilt. You know, if you want to talk about Tony, gaff to the hilt. One of my favorite, but not just with cards, with coins as well. One of my favorite coin routines that I perform to this day is out of power plays. And it's the flipped out Ramsey routine with the flipper in the shelf. Beautiful routine. It's a really good routine. My question is, there's so many purists out there that say, "Oh, you should only use a pack of cards. And if you're doing coins, four coins, no extras." Right. You've released some stuff that is pure, but you're not afraid to use gaff. So what advice would you give to people that are debating about this whole purist, non-purist kind of point of view?
That's a good question. I think all of us prefer to not use a gaff because, first of all, you can get caught with it, which is a real disaster. Diminishing returns, you know, if I use it in a show, I'm going to do a deck switch and probably close with the trick. And I don't know if you read I won't belabor this issue, but there's a Magic Castle routine that uses a shrinking card case, a miniature deck, and a miniature box. And it takes diminishing returns as a full featured closer to a show where the whole deck goes back into the miniature card box and all kinds of stuff happens. So in a formal show, I think anything goes, man. You know, like you've got your deck can be completely set up. You can switch a deck for another setup deck. Now, you would never do this in a walk-around show. So there's a big difference between a formal show and a show that you're doing repeatedly at tables. You want it to reset. Diminishing returns is not as valuable in that context. You need a nicer on a pool table, it's great because you have a nice long run. But if I'm using a close-up pad this big, I probably wouldn't be able to do diminishing returns. In a formal show, I'm in control of everything and would definitely fit into the show. But let me think, I've got off the question. Give me the question again here.
Gaff magic versus purity. When's the right time to use a gaff? And
you know, that's the 74-year-old brain at work there. Anyway, you know, what am I looking at out here? Oh, I've got one of these coins that magnetically comes apart and does crazy stuff. I've got a Boston box because I was practicing Boston Massacre and showing somebody Boston Massacre. If you're going to use a Boston box, then an extra coin is like, you know, so what? I'm not going to constrain myself to four coins when I've already got a gaff box in play. But I think, you know, that gaffed stuff is usually stronger than non-gaffed stuff. I think it was Bob Little that said, as a magician, if you got fooled, it's either gaffed cards, invisible thread, or magnets, or a combination. And 90% of the time, that's right. So, you know, we just forget that, oh, those cards could be split diagonally. And, you know, like, oh my God, how come I didn't see that? Well, because it looks exactly like what it was supposed to be. And you just accepted it and didn't know that the guy had this tricky deck. In terms of practicality, I think I don't generally use any gaffes in a walk around environment in my cards. In coins, it's totally gaffed. I mean, I'm using a 2 copper, 1 silver, or a copper, silver, brass, or a Boston box, or a shell. If you're doing coins and you think that you should only have four coins and you don't have a shell, anybody that's got that shell and half the talent that you have is going to blow you away, because that shell in a coins across routine is going to kill any pure coins across routine. Yep. Because you have five coins, but you can put them on the table, show your hands empty, roll up your sleeves at a nudist colony, and make those coins go across in the most visual and possible way with one shell and four coins. Why wouldn't I do that? You know, I just don't get any sense that purity is a goal. It doesn't, you know, I don't think it is for me. You know, my goal is blow them away as much as possible. And the shell is going to be the way to do it. Mm-hmm. And same thing with the gaffed card. If there's some trick where I can get that gaff in and out and seamlessly and reset, I'll use it every time if it's going to blow people away. You know, like a double facer, McDonald's aces. My God, how pure does that look? It's just unbelievable. Why wouldn't you do McDonald's aces, especially in a formal show? You know, I mean, it's just like, what are you thinking of? If it has to be pure? No, your goal is to blow people away. And anything goes in that regard. That's my rap.
That's I completely agree with you, 100%. Absolutely. So before we move on to the next question, you mentioned a routine that you'd been working on and you'd revisited. And you've talked about how important it is to revisit the routines. Is that something that you would be okay to show us? Would that be all right?
Yeah, sure. I brought my deck here. I'm going to switch to my better view. I think this would be the view to use, where you have this close up in the upper right. I think it gets too busy when you have this. So I'm kind of thinking, you know, yeah, it's kind of cool, but forget it. This is the view. But yeah, this is something I used to use in the restaurant all the time. It's sort of, I always think of it as where science meets magic. And it uses some jokers. Now, normally there's only two jokers in a deck, but I've taken these jokers out of a similar deck, same back design and everything. And then I have the jokers that actually belong in this deck. I think there's another one here somewhere. Okay, the top card is also a joker. So we can use this guy and these guys. So let's I guess I would start it this way. Four jokers. Now, how much conviction is there? There was a face down card there, right? So if we're talking about conviction, I would have to say no. There are four jokers and the backs match each other and match the original deck. So here's where science meets magic, Craig. Rubbing causes friction. Friction causes heat. And heat can actually cause things to become red hot. So that is red hot joker number one. There's three to go. Let's just rub like this. I think that should be sufficient to change another card to red. Now, if you take a red hot card, it very quickly can change another card to red. So that's number two, that's number three. And we've changed three jokers just by rubbing them. What about this one? I'm gonna just rub it through my hand like this. I'm gonna really try to heat this thing up till it's so hot, so darn hot, that it can actually turn the entire deck red. Isn't that a fun one? So my journey here was to revamp the original trick.
That's great.
I can show these jokers. I can flash a couple over there. Magicians are watching, so we don't have to be as careful about thinking, you know, we're talking about something tricky going on here. But the cool thing is that I also figured out how to take those, and I think everybody knows there's got to be some blue cards in there somewhere. So they're set so that I can easily, at the end of any routine with cards, I could put these in the card case and maybe don't want people messing with them, discovering something that I don't want them to discover. In the real world, I would probably just put these in the card case and take them out of sight. But at the end, I can just pull them out, drop the deck on, and almost with just about 15 seconds, completely reset without any false moves. Almost all moves will just show, oh, these started here, this one was in here, and this one was on the top. And so they see me actually restoring it to the exact condition that we started in when I came to the table. and it is. And then I can go to the next table and do the same trick. But as a, this is a really good opener because it's so strong and visual that I think anybody who is there, like, I'm gonna bust this magic, dude. I'm here to figure this stuff out. They're just gonna go, I have no idea. When I used to do this, the deck changed color. I did it at a restaurant and there were some engineers from Notre Dame there. And the one guy goes, is that chemical? He's basically saying, is it chemistry that was at work there? No, what was at work is you bought that this was a blue deck from the beginning and it never was, you know?
Pow.
I loved that moment because I just, he so totally believed that when I did that, that all the blue cards just changed. And how could that happen? It must be the chemical composition. There's some tricky chemistry going on there. I suspect later the other guys went, no, that's impossible. I don't know what happened, but it sure wasn't chemical, you know. But that was a fun moment. But it's a good, strong trick. And
it's unpublished, is it, Mike?
What's that?
That's unpublished.
It is. And I looked around because my wife's a magician also, I should tell you. And that's kind of fun because I remember John Rackerbaumer once said, Mike, these spouses don't understand. Magic is a disease. And I went, well, we know that. Well, my wife's got the disease too. So it's good in that regard. And she's a Chavez graduate from the Chavez School of Magic from Neil Foster, who's not a well-known in the big picture. You may know him because you're knowledgeable, but he was not published but he was a really, really excellent performer. And she was one of the few women that went through the Chavez course in magic, but that's all the classical stuff like Del Salwak does with the billiard balls, cigarettes, you know, some stuff that you can't even do cigarettes anymore. So that's out. But the training and the thinking was very helpful for her to then move to close-up magic when we got married. Then it was sort of like, hey, what are you doing with those cards there? That's not back palming and, you know, Jeff McBridey stuff. It's like close-up magic. So she's become a good close-up magician too.
That's brilliant. That is fantastic. Now, let's talk about your new book because it's Tesseract. Yes. And I think that is each book, you know, I'm a big fan of yours, but I think that's your probably strongest book that you've brought out to date. The material in there is just phenomenal. It really is. Did it take long to put that together? And I know it's only available really exclusively through the Mall of Magic, through you, is that right?
No, Murphy's, everybody's got it. Vanishing Ink has it and Murphy's has it. You can buy it from me. We never, you know, we like that PayPal thing to pop up on my watch. All right, PayPal, you know. So feel free to go to the here it is, mallofmagic.com. But the screen I'm looking at you on, Craig, is on a giant TV and my cameras are in front of it. So if I go like this, it's because my cameras are hiding what I'm trying to see. But anyway, yeah, the Mall of Magic, you can get some of my products there. But to answer your question, in fact, I'll bring the book out. I happen to have a copy of it right over here. And looking over my shoulder, that's the cover, which I thought was very provocative. Somebody said, I thought it would be a book on mentalism. And I thought, yeah, you know, I see what you're saying. But I just wanted to call it Tesseract because it's such a cool concept. And I think it's in the public vocabulary these days. A tesseract is actually a four-dimensional hypercube. And this gizmo right here, which I don't know if I can get this out here. I can show you. Yeah, I guess I can. This is a shadow of a four-dimensional cube. So how can a shadow be three-dimensional? Well, that's what happens when you project something from a higher dimension to the next dimension down. If you project a cube made out of drinking straws, let's say, and you have a light source above it and look at the shadow, it'll look like a square with another square inside and then connections going from the corners, but it's flat. It's a projection of a three-dimensional object into two dimensions. All those little guys are actually perpendicular 90 degrees to their other sides in the original cube. But if you're a two-dimensional creature, you can't conceive of that because you only have two dimensions. Anyway, we're not going to go down. You know, I'd love to talk about this for a couple hours.
I know you.
we'll come back to the view. Yeah, this little baby really took a long time to do. I mean, it's been a long time since Power Plays, but I really did a lot of work here. There's a lot of illustrations. I shot all the photographs myself, which of course was a load of work in itself. There's over 330 photographs, almost 300 pages, 55 items, running the gamut from, you know, that was the last one I looked at was a rubber band routine, a ring and rubber band routine. It took a long time. It took me probably the better part of a year of really, really working hard, writing, and then doing the photographs, doing all the layout, doing the cover artwork. It was a completely in-house project. No, I didn't create, I had to buy the main underlying artwork for this this face that's on here. I did the back cover with myself and the Tesseract, a shadow of the Tesseract, and I thought this is cool. This kind of evokes the fourth dimension in some way. It was a long haul, and I took a long time. I'd been stockpiling material, and I just finally said, okay, you're going to do it. And I knew it was going to be a really big project. It's one of those things, I think people that get into writing a book, you know, you don't know how hard it's going to be because, you know, writing it really clearly, going over it, passing it to some other people to make sure that they can actually make the trick work, making sure your grammar and punctuation and spelling is all correct. Mainly be sure that it works, you know, that it's actually as written, people that read it are going to go, yeah, that worked, whether they liked it or not, at least it you conveyed the right information, the right, described everything properly. So that's a fear when you get down to that last day and you go, well, I'm going to send this in and send a gigantic check to pay the publishers and then hope that it looks good and hope that there's no mistakes in there. And you just cross your fingers and send it on out. And then of course you have to market it and hope that there's going to be interest in the magic community, because the book market has gotten a little softer than when Power Plays came out in 2006. You know, the books don't sell quite as well because of ebooks and also downloads and so on. And there's a lot of competition out there. But anyway, I am proud of the book. I think there's a lot of good material in there. And I did try to run the gamut of everything. I wanted to have non-magic stuff in there. I've got mentalism or non-card stuff. Mentalism, although a lot of it does use cards, it uses them to create a mentalism kind of routine. Ring and string, some coin stuff. But I'm thinking it's about 75% cards. My true love.
It's the way to be. Would you ever do another book? Would you ever do a fifth book? Because I know that you've embraced downloads. You have quite a few downloads. On Mull of Magic, you have tricks, you have the book, Tesseract, but you also have a download section with some amazing downloads in. Yeah, would thanks. You ever do another book, or would it be more of a case of releasing individual downloads?
You know, I mean, historically, people who create stuff do their best work when they're young. I don't know, you know, any given person, obviously Marlowe and Jennings and a lot of the older guys that made it into their old age and were still being creative. I don't know if there are exceptions or if this rule just doesn't exist, but in the big stuff like Isaac Newton or, you know, guys that invented calculus and physics as we know it, they did all this work when they were in their 20s and 18 years old. I mean, are you kidding me? That's the big creative time. Same with Einstein. He did most of his work in his younger age. And of course he continued into his older age, but the real creative stuff was when he was like 20s and 30s. But I'm finding that the journey reading things, getting new ideas. It's just been constantly coming up with ideas and writing them down. I write a column for the Linking Ring magazine called The Card Corner. So once a month, I have to have something in there. And I try to get other people's material in there. People send me things. But I've just realized, you know, I've got a little folder with videos that I've made going, my God, you got like 15 items that are really pretty good, you know, and somewhat tested with people. I'll get together with some guys and go, hey, you know, send me some thoughts on this. And that's always helpful. And I always am very much a credit person. If somebody even just remotely is in there with an idea, their name's going to get mentioned and go, thanks to John Doe for, you know, pointing out that I could have just left that and not turned it over, or that I didn't need to do that one thing. It helped the trick. Why, you know, I'm going to remember that somebody was responsible for that and it wasn't me. I mean, I might have thought of it later, but if somebody, it's that old Marlowe thing, right? No, that guy said it. You know, you were going to say it, but now that he said it, you can't go, no, I was just going to say that. So now I'm taking all the credit. No, you said it. That's your credit. So anyway, I do have a lot of stuff. And, you know, it's funny you should ask about a book, because I'm thinking, geez, you know, am I actually going to dive in again? Wow. You know, this is, I'm still like having a baby. I think Harry Lorraine used to say, I'm still feeling the pain. It was so much work. But then one day you just go, okay, I'm going to, because once I make the move and say, I'm in, I'm all in, and it's going to come out the other side, especially when you announce and say, I'm working on a new book. I'm in. It's going to be, that's the, every day I'll be working on this book until it comes out. Dang. Thanks for giving me that idea again, Craig. Now I may have to go consider doing it.
I really think you should. But you mentioned about how that you're going to be are you going to be releasing more tricks? You mentioned about the Don England routine that, yeah, you're wanting to put together.
I've got it here. Yeah, this is, well, I've got my over the shoulder view again. So this is the cover art for Plastic Lady. And it exists. And this is the back art that actually shows what happens. The Queen of Hearts, I can bring it a little closer here. The Queen of Hearts stretches the long way, stretches sideways, and then shrinks to a mini card. And these other two tens of spades, when you end, it just looks so incredible. You just toss a ten of spades, show both sides, toss a ten of spades, show both sides. What happened to the Queens of Hearts that were over here? Wouldn't it take two of them to do that? Yes, they're gone. And there's nothing to see. I mean, it just looks unbelievable at the end. It's a fantastic trick, totally from Don England. I've got a couple of small contributions to the concept, but they're totally unrelated to what makes the trick what it is, you know, so I don't try to claim any credit, just like, you know, instead of wax, let's use, you know, tape or something, you know, but it's a wonderful trick. And it was in Gaff to the Hilt, actually. I guess one innovation that I had was that he actually would take a playing card and cut the back design off of the playing card to fit onto a mini card, so that the back of the mini card actually had a section of a normal card on it. And his goal was then you could spread the cards, and the mini card in the spread would just flash that little part of the back that was glued on it. So he actually made, if you got all the Gaffs from Gaff to the Hilt, Don England made one for every book that was sold, about 500 copies of the original book sold with all the Gaffs handmade by Don England. That means he made something like 500 mini cards with a back on them. And one of the things I said, hey, Don, when I bought the rights from him, I said, Don, why are we doing that? And I spread the cards with the mini card back showing just briefly. And then I said, nobody's going to even notice that that's a mini back. It's got the same color. And then I showed him, you don't even need to show it. You can just do a count that shows three card backs, and you never even saw that. So why are we spending, you know, a half an hour of your time times 500 to make something that's not even examinable? When you do it this way, the card is examinable. That's the one they want to see, not those tens. That's card shrunk to a miniature card and stretched. They want to go, what is that thing? How could it do that? And now they're grabbing the wrong card. There's only one thing they can't touch out there out of those three. And you can easily switch it out with a Himber wallet or something and really clean. But in his case, the one they really want to grab wasn't even examinable. So I guess I did have a contribution, but ultimately, I did do that. I don't even mention it in here. I just say, this is Don England's trick, because it doesn't really, you know, it made it better, but not in a way that I really feel like I contributed to the trick. The genius of the trick is all Don England, other than that one little tweak, you know.
And can you get that from Mole of Magic now, can you? Is that something that's available?
I do have a bunch of these. I was about to go out on a lecture tour. I was out, I think it was last October, you know, I can't remember what year it was, a couple way back somewhere, 2 years, 1 year ago, I did about the 14 city lecture tour, and I had a bunch of these with me and sold a bunch of them. And I was supposed to be going out. Tom Craven was setting up a lecture tour for me to go out into the South and into Florida and up a little bit north of Florida. And we had all these things worked out. And that was when COVID hit, and you could just see everything canceling out because it was like getting into, let's see, what month was that going to be? I think the lectures were going to be in April. So there was no way that it was going to happen. March is when it started to really hit. And by April, everybody's going, no, we're not going to have a lecture live anymore. So that it just folded up. So I've got about, I had 100 of these all set up to take out. So I've still got probably 75 of them sitting around here. Feel free to go to Magic.
So go on to the Mole of Magic. There you go. That's great. I'm going to as soon as I finish this interview. That sounds great.
You know what? Actually, I've mentioned one thing real quickly, Craig. To avoid shipping costs to Europe, what I realized was if I put this into an envelope, it ends up being some outrageous amount of money. But if I put this into an envelope and just give you the link to the video instruction, all you didn't get was this packaging that doesn't do anything. I can put this into an envelope for like 90 cents and send it anywhere in the world. So I'm suggesting that's the way to go. If you're out of the country, why incur some, you know, shipping costs that are pretty irrelevant if we just send the card. So that's cool. So that's probably what I would do for folks in the UK.
Brilliant. I as soon as I finish this interview, I'm ordering one of those. That sounds great.
I got one for you. You're giving me a lot of good press today. You certainly deserve opportunity. Maybe you'll come up with a great idea for it.
Thanks, Mike. I want to ask you one more thing before we wrap all this up, which is you have spent a long time performing in restaurants. And you've done quite a lot of restaurant magic over the years. And you've mentioned it quite a few times over the course of this interview. Yeah. It's in the UK, at least, it's something that every magician wants to get into because it's somewhere where you can really kind of hone your craft and you can get better. And it gives you an opportunity to perform to real people on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Have you got any advice on working a restaurant, both in terms of kind of maybe the approach or trick selection or just any advice on working restaurants? Because I know that's something that you've done an awful lot.
Yeah, I probably will cover things that guys like Dan Fleshman may have covered on his restaurant magic stuff. But I don't know, have any particular thing of originality. One thing I used to do, I think it was actually in Power Plays, was something called the Card of Mystery. I can't remember the name of the trick, but the idea was that on your laser jet printer, a color printer or an inkjet printer, you can print on paper that's sticky, right? That you can cut up and glue to the back of a card. So you can make your own gaffed card, so to speak. So in this case, you go into a restaurant and you can have the restaurant's logo, and it's called the Roscoe's Card of Mystery card. And you get the owner to say, I'm going to give you some special cards to pass out to the customers that give them a free dessert for when they come the next time, not tonight, but the next time. So you tell the owner, listen, when I go to the tables, first of all, I'm going to make these guys want to come back and send their friends in here because they're going to like my show. You've seen my show. You brought your staff out to watch the show. I know you liked what you saw. You know that your customers are going to like what you saw. If you can't say that, you're not going to get the gig no matter what you do. You better have a good show. So this is another thing where you can say, listen, I've got some ideas of how to promote the restaurant while I'm going to the tables. One thing that I think it came from Paul Cummins was an approach that I think is impossible to ignore. In other words, hey, did you guys lose this red knife? Oh, no, it's a blue knife. What? You know, what is this guy doing? You know, oh, he must be the magician. Oh, okay. No, you walk up and go, hi, I'm the magician here tonight. Tonight's magic night. And the owner asked me to stop at the table and show you a quick trick. Is this a good time? How can you not say, sure, you know, or you could say, well, I was just about to propose magic to this woman over here. So maybe come back later. You know, that's going to happen. But generally, they are going to feel like the owner asked the guy to come to the table.
Yeah.
How can you not just say, sure. Now you said it's a quick trick. It's one quick trick. The owner asked me to come over here. That's a guaranteed one trick at the table. Now do something that's going to make them, then you get to go, have you got time for another quick one? And if they don't go yes, then that was inevitable and you got your quick trick in. And then you say, hey, by the way, let me show you this trick whereby you can win a free dessert. And then the trick guarantees them to win. It looks like you're faking them out with this trick I mentioned from Power Plays, where it looks like, wait a minute, you know, he's trying to trick us into getting the wrong card. Then it turns out, no, every single card is a winner card now. It's like a wild card routine where the cards change from something to where there's one winning card. Suddenly they're all winners instead of them thinking, oh, he's going to fake me out and I'm going to lose. No, you always win when you come to Roscoe's. You know, here's your card for a free dessert the next time you come in. Thanks for having me over. So now you got two tricks in, gave them a card that gets them to come back to the restaurant. And maybe they'll even ask you to come back later, or they'll say, wait a minute, no, now we do want you to do another one. But sometimes people just don't like magic, or they've got something going on. You know, John here just came back from college and we're trying to, you know, it's not the best time for you to be here. And it really isn't, you know, it's totally the best thing for them is like, you know, we're just focusing on, hey, how's things going in college? You know, it's your first year. So I think you got to be prepared for rejection, not fear rejection. That line is going to get you in there every time. That's an amazing way to get to the table and get that first trick in without, you know, some fake stuff like, did you drop this knife or whatever that we used to do because we didn't know any better way to get them to accept you. Make your opener be really strong. I almost always open with ambitious card because it's so strong and so impossible looking and so clean at every point in the routine that I do. And I think everybody can come up with a routine that they're so convinced that card's here and there, and it just keeps coming to the top and they just keep coming in and you get that one last time and then it jumps to a different pile or rises visibly or something. Whoever was in there going, oh yeah, I've sent that magician over. I know this stuff. I'm going to figure this out. That guy's going, people are looking at him going, well, and he goes, I have no freaking idea. Do another one, you know? So that's what you want to have happen. That first trick is really important in establishing your talent. It's not Uncle Joe with the quarter behind the ear. It's a guy who's an expert and you can't figure out what he's doing. And it's amazing. Your first trick has to do that.
That's really, really, really good advice. That really is. That really is. Let me ask you one last question to wrap all this up. And this is the question that I ask everyone. Everyone I've had on this channel, I've asked them the same question.
Oh boy, I'm getting worried now.
No. What's next? Now we've talked about the possibility of another book, but to be clear, Mike, your legacy is set. You know, you have spent a lifetime creating, performing really strong commercial magic that people all over the world perform, and so many amazing routines. What's next in terms of what you're planning? Obviously, we've talked about the potential of another book, but I mean, are you going to be lecturing again when you're able? Are you doing Zoom lectures? What's down the road for you?
Wow, good question. And you know, I think there's definitely a few things that come to mind, and then hopefully the unknown ones that pop up after this interview that I could have told you if I'd have thought of them before. I am working with a couple guys on a Zoom show. I think we were talking earlier before the interview that we had launched the show and had good success with it. We got a $100 tip, so I figured they must have liked the show. But Zoom shows are a strange thing. And I have a lot of equipment and I've been working on trying to make, in fact, quickly for anybody doing a Zoom show, you want it to be really look cool. You don't want to be, you know, with your tables tilted over this way and oh my God, you know, so be sure that you have it really project professionalism into your audience. So I think we'll be doing some Zoom shows. I think that's a thing that's going to continue along. If you have seen Carissa Hendricks's lecture, I think she did one for the SAM that might be available to watch. And she really talks a lot about, you know, the future of magic in the new Zoom world and beyond. Even when we get back to normal, Zoom's not going away. I can be in Las Vegas. I can be at a birthday party where they've got some people around the TV set and then 30 people all around the world that are being there by Zoom because they are embracing Zoom 5 years from now as a way to bring people who are away to the party. And I can be on all their screens at the same time and they don't have to fly me in. I mean, my God. So my pricing, they won't have a hotel room, their budget. When they hear my number, they used to have to add in, yeah, that fee plus all these other things in my contract that you have to pay for. So it's a thing that's going to stay. And I'm trying to get into that a bit. I'm just somewhat new to it, but it looks like that the future will have that. I'm going to be lecturing for Penguin in their performance lecture mode. I was going to lecture in January, which is this month. And I think I had just talked to Sean Dunn recently and kind of bailed out and said, you know, this has been going nuts here. I want to really come in there prepared with a solid show for you guys. And so we're going to roll it down to later in the year.
Sean is a really great guy. He cares so much.
He really is. And, you know, sometimes we think these big corporate things are just guys that are in making the money, but Sean's a great guy. He loves magic. I see him at Vectors now, so he's getting around as the magician in his own right as well. But he knows good stuff, and he's been really good to me, and I'll be doing that sometime in 2021, I think. I'd love to do a Magic Castle one more time. I did it in 1996. You know, before I have to be like Vernon with a cane and kind of go in there like hardly able to get around with my walker. You know, before that happens, I'd like to get in and go to California and do another show with those guys. I've got some ideas for a Penn and Teller trick.
I'd love to see you put on Penn and Teller, Mike. I would love to see you on Penn and Teller.
I've got a good idea that one of which I know would fool them. And the other of which is the more likely one that they would pick as that's cool. So I'm tempted to just say, no, I'm going to send this one in. And if they don't bite on that one, which I'm pretty sure would fool them, and because you get that trophy and then you're a star, you know, everybody, you got to want to fool them. I mean, I realize that it's an honor to be on the show. If they said, well, yeah, we don't like that one. And I pitched the other one. I know they'd figure it out, but I'd be on the show and it would be fine. And I guess there's a chance they wouldn't, but I think they would. So I've got a couple ideas. I've just got to get off and get a good video that's not going to, you know, I need to get out and you need to have people with you that to get that energy, you know, like you're showing people like these downloads and stuff and people running around in the streets of Las Vegas and the crowd comes in. It seems like you want something more than just me sitting in this room saying, you know, if Penn and Teller were here, I'd say, tell her to do this. I think you really have to have some people, maybe lay people that, you know, react to the trick. And I need to do that. Unfortunately, nobody wants to come in without a mask on. So it becomes a weird scene. But sometime in 2021, I may try to accomplish that. And then a lecture tour for sure. We got the one that Tom was setting up. Would be great to go visit some clubs in person. Although, who knows? They might go, you know, we're thinking it's going to be cheaper to just, you know, not have to pay a room for you. And why don't you just do a Zoom thing with us? So if that happens, I think but the rig that I showed you here is a good sales pitch for a superior environment to teach in. I've got that over the shoulder view that I showed the books in. I can do them all at the same time. You know, so I think that I can pitch my lecture as really solid teaching techniques here, you know, aside from hopefully really solid magic as well. So that's kind of what I'm hoping for in 2021. The book, you know, you've opened the Pandora's box again. I had opened it, but then I closed it, and now you opened it today again. So I might have to stare in that box one more time and go, oh my God, am I going to do this? But I've got a lot of material, so exactly. We don't know yet.
And I mentioned to people that I was going to be speaking to you and interviewing you for the channel. And I had several people say to me, and I mentioned this before the interview even started to you, please ask Mike if he's ever going to release Holy Terror again, because it's this underground thing that new people get into magic and they go on the cafe or somewhere and they ask about moving holes, because moving holes is a plot that's always fascinating. There's always new things coming out. And everybody always recommends one of two things. No matter how many new things come out, it's always either your routine or the pothole trick by Michael Close. Those are the two that always get recommended. So people want to know, is that coming out again?
Boy, you know, this might be, from my point of view, the best thing in the interview that I take from the interview, which is maybe getting a kick in the butt to get that done, because I've been sitting on this. It's got to be years. Every once in a while, somebody on one of the magic sites will send me a personal message, and it goes, didn't you say like in 2010 that you were going to be coming out with this, or it might have been 2003, you know, that you were going to release it? You know, how's that going, Mike? Where's the DVD? And I think at this point, the teaching part of it, I've got the stuff to do a really great job of teaching it. All I've got to do is get somewhere to go to get that sexy opening thing where the people on the streets of Las Vegas are going bonkers because they're seeing these holes move. If I could find out how to get that done, I think you'd push me over the edge and go, this is the year for this, Craig. I think it's got to be the year for it. You know, I'm not getting any younger. Quit talking and get off, you know, as they, you know, S or get off the pot, as the expression goes. And yeah. Maybe that's the first thing I ought to be doing this year. It's like, okay, you can't do anything else until you get that done, because that's an important one. You're really right. It really should come out this year.
It really should. So many people want to see it. So many people want to see it. And we're wrapping the whole thing up now, but I want to ask you one last thing. Yeah. And I'm really going to put you on the spot here. Out of everything you've ever created, in every book and every standalone trick and every download, what's your favorite routine?
Holy Terror.
It's got to come out, man. It's got to come out.
There's no question about it. I mean, when we talk about strong magic, that's the one. It's the strongest thing that I could do for people. And the testimonial I've had other people give the same testimonial, which is, I've had a couple times a person, because you give them the card, it's a signed card with their name on it, no switcheroo where I put something on the deck and then, oh geez, you know, what did he do on the deck there to get this card in play? No, the one you saw the whole move on, you can take it. I'm not changing it. It's there. That's what makes it so strong. And I've had in the mall. I'm sorry, Craig.
I was going to say, and I think that's the weakness with a lot of the newer tricks that have come out. You can move it around and make it look all sexy, but then you have to put it on top of the deck for absolutely no reason whatsoever in order to then give it to you.
Yeah, that's right. And everybody knows, I think, that sees it, that was where the switch was done to the real card. They're not idiots. There's no reason to not just say here. And that's what you kind of get to do with Holy Terror. But the killer was when a guy stops me in the mall and goes, hey, there's that guy. Come here, Mike. He didn't remember my name. He's, come here. You're the guy. And he pulls it out of his wallet. He goes, he's the guy that did that. And that means he's showing that card to people going, how in the heck could this happen? These holes were moved on the card I signed. And I had a guy, it was really funny. I was at John Lucas convention and a guy from Canada goes, he's sitting next to me and he goes, have you ever seen Holy Terror? And I went, Yeah, I created Holy Terror. He goes, oh my God, I didn't look at your badge. He went, oh my God, this is the best trick I do. You know, and he had the same story. He said, I have had people say, there's the guy, look at this, it's in their wallet. That's the guy that did this. You know, you don't get that reaction out of very many tricks, and Holy Terror is one of them that you do. So, man, now that I've sold it out here in cyberspace, I better get off my butt and get this done.
You got to get it done. You have to get it done, because I review magic. That's part of the thing that I do on this channel. And I see so many routines that come out, and I always go back. Well, I can't do Holy Terror anymore, but I do, we talked about it beforehand. I do the impromptu version from Power Plays, but I love that routine.
The latest version, I don't even think is in print, and it really has taken the conviction to another level. And I think if you compare to maybe what you had seen earlier, or the earlier versions of this, you'll see like, oh boy, you really have added something. Now it adds to the complexity of what you have to do to set it up, but it's not a deal breaker. Anybody has what they need at home to completely set up a deck to do this moving hole thing in a really super convincing way. And it doesn't involve palming or any weird, you know, really heavy duty, crazy moves either. The move, I guess you should say, you're going to probably feel a little awkward the first time you do it. But the third time or fourth time you do it, you're going to go, there it is. It's not like the diagonal palm shift or something where you spend your life learning a move. This is a really easy move. And the trick, I can easily, honestly say, it's going to be the average magician should be able to do it.
That was amazing. Well, we've actually talked about power plays a lot over the course of this. Can you get power plays anymore? Because it's not on your website. And I know every time I do an interview and I talk about a book, people rush off to buy that book. And I know, obviously, you can get Tesseract, and you really should, because it's amazing. Can you get that anywhere?
You know, I'll tell you what, when I'm lecturing, here's my lecture stuff here, and over the shoulder again. So this is now power plays at my lecture. And basically what it is simply a disc with a PDF file on it. So ultimately there's no point in having me mail this to you because it's a PDF file. So there's now on my website a link to a company called PayHip. I don't even know that you know what you're dealing with. It just says buy the download here for $19.95. So the book is now downloadable as an ebook. So it's all searchable. It's all the original text searchable and everything. That's the only form. I have my copy that's over here, and I have one copy that maybe I'll give to my grandson if he gets into magic. That's all I've got. That's the end. So I don't even have any here to sell if I wanted to. So, but it is available. I think it's worthwhile. I think Penguin has it and library.com has it. But feel free to visit Mall of Magic and find it on there, and you'll get an immediate download through the service that I work with once the PayPal goes through.
I'm gonna put a link down below to the actual page on the Mall of Magic. So of course, I reviewed that recently as well, and I told everyone to buy it. So yeah, I'll put a link on there for you.
All right. Hey, listen, email me your address, man. You certainly deserve a couple of cards that to have some fun with Plastic Lady. The only thing I'd ask is do some thinking. Maybe you'll have a great idea for it.
And if I do, I'll let you know. Thanks, Mike.
I'll put your name on it.
that would make my day. Boy, that would make my day. Mike, I want to say thank you so much for coming on the channel. I'm telling everybody right now that is watching this, and I know a lot of people are going to watch this, of course, they always do. When you have to go, if you haven't seen any of Mike Power's material, you have to go to the Mall of Magic. You have to check out some of his stuff, buy some of his downloads, get Tesseract, get Power Plays. You are one of my favorite magicians and an amazing thinker of magic. And Mike, on behalf of the magic community, thank you for everything that you've done over the years. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Craig. It's really fun doing the interview with you. Good to see you. I'll see you down the way in England sometime.
Hopefully come over to do a lecture in England. That'd be amazing.
Love to, man.
you know what? I did an interview with Russ Stevens, who's in the Black, who organises the Blackpool Magic Convention. Maybe I need to make a phone call to Russ and say, look, when Blackpool starts again, get Mike Powers over. I think that would be
that would be fun.
Awesome. We'll make that happen. Mike, thank you so much. And everybody else that's watching this, make sure you subscribe to the channel. I'm going to be back again tomorrow with a review show with Ryland. I'll see you then. Thanks very much. Mike, once again, see you again soon.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast. Magic. Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel. Magic TV. Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.